Is there evidence that NATO assisted Israel in its attack on Iran last week? Are Canada and Europe revving up their military spending in preparation for a broader war this could lead to? Could the disruption caused by the explosion of a regional war with Iran finally signal the end of the American empire? What further moves by the United States could be taken to avert the final collapse of American imperialism? This week on the Global Research News Hour, we look at the recent attack on Iran by Israel and the reciprocal attacks by Iran and the alarming direction this exchange of missiles could lead to in the not-too-distant future. In our first half hour, we talk to military analyst Drago Bosnick about the latest developments and the possibility of the greater powers getting into the fray. And in our second half hour, the economist, writer, and radio broadcaster Jack Rasmus is back to look at the history of decline of the U.S. empire and the latest damage this strike against Iran will do to the fate of the U.S. empire. On this week's program, the Israel-Iran conflict escalates. End of empire, end of peace, end of humanity. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of June 20th, 2025. The program is funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. I'm your host, Michael Welch. The show seeks to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our shows are available to partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. We acknowledge this program was produced on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, the Innu, the Ojibwe, the Dene, and the Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. The land was taken from the people who lived here first through broken treaties, false promises, and force. The current generation of settlers cannot deal in a respectful and humane way with the indigenous people without being aware of the injustice and the real history and efforts should be made to reverse these trends, make reparations for past injuries, and proceed equitably and respectfully in the spirit of partnership and friendship. Now it's time for News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Listeners should know that some of the articles may run against common messaging about sensitive subjects and are not all endorsed by this radio station. When the U.S. imperial elites in government, deep state, and military-industrial complex shift the machinery of war into first gear and the war train leaves the station, there is no calling it back. The gears of war were set in motion in 2002 in the case of the Iraq War, in 2021 in Ukraine, and sometime during 2024 in the current case of Iran. War plans are developed and the funding sources identified and earmarked months and sometimes years before military action is initiated. Once the decision is made, what remains is mostly the timing, i.e., when is it best to pull the trigger? That timing depends on getting the necessary military assets in place, lining up agreement to go to war with key players in Congress and U.S. allies, preparing public opinion by creating an imminent threat image with the U.S. public, and, if time and conditions permit, staging a, quote, false flag, unquote, event to give credibility to the imminent threat. That comes from the article, How America Goes to War, Iraq, Ukraine, and Now Iran, by Dr. Jack Rasmus, posted June 19th. The official said the U.S. side wanted to water down the draft statement, and Canada felt this would not be fair to Ukraine, whose president arrived at the summit on Tuesday, Reuters reported. Given the impasse, only six of the seven member countries released a joint statement on Ukraine. This impasse over Ukraine demonstrates how the G7 is no longer the leading group of major countries and economies, which BRICS is rapidly replacing, as they can no longer even agree on their hegemonic designs. Although the U.S. disagreed with Canada, Germany, Italy, the United Kingdom, Japan, and France on the Ukraine issue, it will certainly not withdraw from the group, as it is another forum where it can exert its influence over these wealthy countries whilst also attempting to resist the rise of BRICS. Nonetheless, the G7 has been losing demographic and economic weight, and it seeks to co-opt BRICS leaders because it recognizes that today there is no way to discuss the dynamics of the world economy or the direction of governance without involving the global south. That comes from the article, G7 Abandons Joint Statement on Ukraine Due to U.S. Objections, by Ahmed Adel, posted June 19th. 70 years after President Dwight D. Eisenhower warned about the cost of a military-industrial complex, America is still stealing from its own people to fund a global empire. In 2025 alone, the U.S. has launched airstrikes in Yemen, Operation Rough Rider, bombed Houthi-controlled ports and radar installations, killing scores of civilians, deployed greater numbers of troops and multiple aircraft carriers to the Middle East, and edged closer to direct war with Iran in support of Israel's escalating conflict. Each of these quote-unquote new fronts has been sold to the public as national defense. In truth, they are the latest outposts in a decades-long campaign of empire maintenance, one that lines the pockets of defense contractors while schools crumble, bridges collapse, and veterans sleep on the streets at home. This isn't about national defense. That comes from the article, The Real National Emergency, Endless Wars, Failing Infrastructure, and a Dying Republic, by John W. Whitehead and Nisha Whitehead, posted June 19th. The day-to-day back and forth of missile and drone strikes continues, and given the first day's success, Netanyahu and other Israeli leaders have now also spoken of totally destroying the Iranian capital, Tehran, a city of 18 million, which would not be turned to Gaza-like rubble using conventional weapons. Should anyone doubt that the insane Netanyahu would do such a thing, initiating the first battlefield use of such weapons since 1945, they should examine the Prime Minister's record on reckless behavior, in which he has no rival among national leaders. He would unhesitatingly, quote, defend his country and his leadership, unquote, by initiating an escalation that could have devastating consequences if other nuclear powers like Pakistan get involved in support of the Iranians. And then there is the role of President Donald Trump, whose tone deafness on any issue that might require a minimum of a few seconds of contemplation is well established. The Trumpster has already contradicted himself several times over whether he knew in advance about Israel's somewhat of a surprise attack on Iran and whether the U.S. was involved. That comes from the article, Nuclear War a la Mode, Trump and Netanyahu Conspire to Destroy Iran, Dr. Philip Giraldi, by Philip Giraldi, posted June 18th, originally published on the UNS Review. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu. There are alarming indications that a major war is being planned and that it will be a World War III. Could we deliberately or accidentally launch ourselves into World War III? What can be done to eliminate this threat before it's too late? Joining us to discuss this is Global Research NewsHour military analyst Drago Bosnick. Thanks for joining us, Drago.
The pleasure is all mine. Thank you, Michael.
Israel recently launched an attack on Iran as a preemption against an attack by Iran. It was a totally illegal thing, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, we have no evidence that Iran was planning to launch an attack on Israel Because they would have done that long ago. They would have done that in the months after the October 7th and the escalation in Gaza to prevent the destruction of that area. However, we didn't see that. So what we actually saw is that that Israel launched a bunch of these decapitation strikes against not just Iran but all of its allies. So for those who don't remember, after the death, the very, very controversial, very mysterious death of President Raisi, the situation has actually become pretty bad for the axis of resistance, because it lost Syria, it lost some of its major allies, including the leader of Hezbollah, Hassan Nasrallah, who was the leader since 1992, if I'm not mistaken. So he's been a leader for over 30 years at the time of his death, and he was considered one of the most important people in Hezbollah, because Hezbollah actually reached its zenith in terms of power under his leadership. So the loss of Nasrallah was a major blow to not just Hezbollah itself, but also Iran and its proxies in the region. So we can say that it was Israel that launched a very... let's say, in-depth and a comprehensive attack on Iran, targeting, it is sort of like a asymmetric hybrid warfare, a combination of intelligence operations and military operations to ensure that Iran's entire power structure collapses. And after the launch of the attack over the weekend, on Friday, if I'm not mistaken, they launched a bunch of attacks that targeted the higher echelons of power in the Iranian military, especially the Revolutionary Guard. So according to latest reports, they killed between 10 and 20 generals and other high-ranking officers. So the obvious goal in this case is to decapitate the Iranian military leadership, to paralyze the chain of command, and to ensure that the Iranians cannot respond. Another thing is, they were also hitting the entrances into these missile bases that are built into the mountains in Iran, especially in the western parts of the country, where these missile bases were designed to withstand major attacks. So, of course, Israel, having very advanced technologies and access to advanced ISR being intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, they were able to conduct these pinpoint strikes on the entrances, blocking them, and of course trapping most of the or much of the Iranian missile arsenal within those mountain bases. So of course this prevents Iran from using all of its forces to strike Israel. So of course, I mean, I just want to say, a lot of people who support Iran don't are failing to recognize how how effective these operations by Israel have been. We don't have to like or dislike Israel. We have to accept the fact that Israel was very successful in these attacks, and simply trying to pretty much ignore this is self-defeating, especially for the Iranians. I mean, the many people in Iran, they demand retribution for these attacks. But unfortunately for Iran, they're not able to reciprocate in the same manner, because they cannot, they don't have access to the same level of technology or the same the same type of information that Israel has. Also, we have to note that Israel has tremendous help from NATO, and even the countries in the region, because if anything, countries in the region are allowing Israeli aircraft to intercept Iranian drones. So Israel is, Israel has a bunch of allies, and countries that are not really, they're not admitting they're allies of Israel, but they are still helping them to defend themselves against these Iranian strikes, which are retaliatory in nature, because Israel was the one to launch the first attack. So in essence, what we see, this is definitely a dangerous escalation, because the Iranians are now becoming desperate. The Iranians will have to respond with everything they have. And then this could push Israel itself to use nuclear weapons. This is what's really dangerous.
Yeah, well, I mean, you've just said that I guess there's evidence that that NATO is assisting Israel in these attacks, but
Absolutely.
they're not doing so openly. So I'm just
Yeah,
wondering. Yeah, well,
they're not
if
doing that openly. They're still not attacking Iran itself directly, but what they're doing is they're providing logistics, they're providing intelligence, they're providing surveillance. And this includes even Germany. Even Germany sent its aerial tankers to help the Israelis. They had, Luftwaffe aircraft was flying over Jordan. One of Luftwaffe aircraft actually turned on one of its transponders accidentally, supposedly, as they claim, and it was picked up by these websites to track aircraft like flight radar, for example. So the thing is, Israel is not alone in any of this, and the EU has already said that they will support Iran. Sorry, that they will support Israel. Trump has said several times that he will do the same. Trump actually said it, I think it was today or this morning, he said that he doesn't care about the intelligence services, US intelligence services saying that Iran is not developing a nuclear weapon. He claims that they are. So that means that somebody else is feeding him this information. And it might be the Mossad, it might be some other intelligence agencies that have very close ties with the Mossad. So, in essence, Israel is using all of its influence to ensure that Iran is defeated. Now, this is where we come to the question of World War III that you just asked. It is the major question. I don't think that Russia or China will start a nuclear war because of Iran. However, the issue is neither Russia nor China want the failure of the government in Iran. For them, this is this is a crucial question, because if there's a regime change operation in Iran, then both countries are getting another enemy behind their backs, essentially. So what that means, if let's say if Iran collapses, or if there is a color revolution that brings a pro-Western government to power, that means that the Central Asia will be wide open to another influx by NATO or by the West. So that means that the West would come essentially behind Russia's back or behind China's back. And then this creates a bunch of strategic issues for both countries. China is defending itself against NATO or essentially US, but also partially NATO encroachment in the Asia Pacific. So having to contend with that in Central Asia is obviously problematic, because it's like almost like an encirclement. And the same goes for Russia. The Russians already have NATO on their western borders, and if Iran is to fall, that means that the entire front actually extends along Russia's southern border, which is very, it's essentially what we call the soft underbelly. So it's a geostrategic or strategic geopolitical soft underbelly. And of course, this is a very, very sensitive area for Russia, especially in recent times, when we see countries like Kazakhstan, which is supposed to be allied to Russia, but they have contacts with the West, but particularly the UK. So we see attempts to destabilize regions and areas directly or indirectly bordering China and Russia. So all of this means that it's a coordinated attack. Also, another thing, Israeli operations within Iran are very reminiscent of what the Ukrainians are doing within Russia. So again, we see something that can only be described as a coordinated attack on much of the multipolar world.
Germany, I mean, have plans. I mean, from the document that that they were going to launch a preemptive war against Russia, basically expecting Russia to attack. You kind of like the way Israel say they preemptively attack Iran to protect against the reverse. So I'm just wondering. I mean, if you can talk about that issue and the role of Annalise. Baerbock and all of this, because I mean, for being the voice of it and then becoming the elected in June of just recently elected to the presidency of the United Nations. I mean, where does she fit into all of this? Is she going to be
Well,
christening the war or something like that, or what?
I mean, it's a great question. First of all, she effectively declared war on Russia at some point, but because when she was the foreign minister, she said, and I quote, I might not get the exact quote, but that's pretty much, I'm paraphrasing actually. She said, "We are at war with Russia. We need to focus on that, right?" So somebody was asking, I think somebody was asking about corruption in Ukraine, and then she responded back, retorted saying, "We don't care about that. We are at war with Russia." So this is what's really problematic. These people are beyond delusional, and of course, being delusional is not, it's not a problem per se, unless a delusional person comes to power or is, representing a country or can make decisions. Now, as you said, she was elected as one of the top people at the UN recently. So I think this is the proof that the UN cannot be considered an impartial organization. Because, I mean, can you imagine the UN electing Medvedev for any function at all, or any other Russian official? I can.
Good
I
point.
can, to be honest. So the whole point is the entire international system, which is, well, pretty much controlled by the so-called rules-based world order, is being used against the multipolar countries, against the multipolar powers, whether they are global or regional. So, for instance, I've heard reports that the International Atomic Agency it effectively helped the Israelis to get a list of key Iranian nuclear scientists who were then assassinated by the Mossad. So what that means essentially is that the system is being used against these countries, and it's only a matter of time before they decide to create parallel institutions, or they can be defeated. I mean, it's up to them. The point is, the entire so-called international law system is rigged against countries that are non-compliant with the political West and what the political West wants. So, and this has been the case for decades. I mean, this is nothing new, essentially. But the point is, it's never been as obvious as it is today. And the issue with the potential for nuclear war is precisely the fact that if Iran falls, and if there is a domino effect that goes all the way to that affects the South Caucasus and Central Asia, the developments that we might see as a result of that might lead to the escalation that could result in World War III. So if Russia is surrounded on, let's say, three sides, if China is surrounded on two or three sides, what that means is they will be left with no other choice but to use nuclear weapons, because they will not be able to, let's say, push back against all of the countries that the West takes under its control and then launches a massive conventional attack against these countries. So, of course, I'm talking about long term. This is not going to happen like in the next 2 or 3 months or even years. This is just a long term plan to ensure that China and Russia are defeated as the as the strongest adversaries of the so-called rules-based world order. China is particularly problematic for the United States because the Chinese, it's only a matter of time before the Chinese economic power, which is unprecedented, translates to military power at some point.
I
And
think I'd like to
yeah.
maybe address one point is that I mean just we just finished the G7 summit. It was here in Canada, and we see that as we reported last week on the last show, both Europe and Canada are really revving up their military spending. Now they say if you were going to be taking on a fight on this scale, you've got to be ready in advance. And so I'm just wondering if you there are any indications that you've seen or could spot or point to that that these elites on the rules-based system, as you call it, have advanced knowledge of what's coming and are getting ready in
Well,
advance.
Of course, they have advanced knowledge because they're the ones who are planning for all this to happen. Like, this is not something that's going on, just out of the blue, or it's happening without any coordination. This is something that they've been planning for decades. And I mean, this is not even like a conspiracy theory. You just have to read the Wolfowitz Doctrine, for example. In the early 1990s, when the after the USSR collapsed, the U.S. said, and I mean, in no uncertain terms, that it's unacceptable that for the United States to ever see a power as strong as the USSR was to ever appear on planet Earth, because of course the United States would then be challenged by the power of that country, and of course China is pretty much very close to becoming what the USSR was in the 70s and 80s, for example, and the thing is. They view China as a far more dangerous opponent because China is an economic power. So the USSR was economically strong, but much of its economy was geared towards creating a military. So and that's why in the late 1980s, the USSR had the most powerful military in the history of mankind, including our timeline. So because at the time they had nearly 50,000 nuclear weapons, which is several times more, which is about 5 times more than the entire arsenal of the world today. So, and of course, it had a massive conventional military that could also defeat most or any opponent on the planet, including the United States itself. So, after the collapse of this country, the U.S. said, "Okay, we have to ensure that never again we have an opponent like that." However, they failed in doing so because China is the one that's developing to become sort of like a USSR 2.0. And for the time being, their military power, the Chinese military power, despite being in the top three in the world, is still not nowhere near the power of the USSR in the 1980s. However, if things continue this way, China will be able to translate its enormous economic power into military power by the end of this decade and in years after 2030, when it becomes possible for China to start projecting power around the world. And of course, this is extremely problematic for the United States. So the U.S. is planning to continue the Pax Americana or the U.S. dominance well into the 21st century. And in order to achieve that, it needs to prevent China from becoming the USSR 2.0. In order to achieve that, they also need to defeat countries like Russia and Iran. Of course, the problematic thing is while you can defeat a country like Iran, defeating a country like Russia is extremely unlikely because Russia itself still has, a massive, it has the largest nuclear arsenal in the world. And it has very advanced missiles and other weapons that could obliterate most of the world. So they have to find a way to prevent Russia from recovering its former strength fully, or even destroy the country itself. And this is what the Atlantic and these other prominent Atlanticist think tanks have been saying. They want to decolonize Russia. That was the actual term they used back in 2022. Decolonizing Russia. And the whole point is they want to ensure that the Russian Federation is pretty much broken apart into these smaller federal units that can then be destroyed piecemeal or absorbed into the Western alliance, and then they can move on towards eliminating China. So this is a very all of this is a very is a set of very complex strategic plans to ensure that the dominance of the United States and NATO continues well into the 21st century.
Okay, I gotta call it there, but thanks so much for your analysis, Vago.
Of course, the pleasure is all mine.
Drago Bosnic is our regular analyst on military affairs, and he joined us from Serbia. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. With the looming defeat of the NATO war against Russia in Ukraine, the rise of U.S. partner Israel in the looming war with Iran, and major unrest in the streets of the United States this past weekend. A lot of people are saying that the almighty United States isn't what it used to be, and consider it an empire that's about to collapse. America for sure has seen better days, and it may be in decline, but it is far from finished as an empire. But that's the subject of Jack Rasmus's latest book, Twilight of American Imperialism. He joins us not too long ago to explain the current plans of Donald Trump with his tariffs and astonishing goals of acquiring Greenland, Panama, and even Canada as the fourth in a string of economic adjustments. He's going to discuss his ideas further in the wake of what's currently happening in the Middle East and the Ukraine proxy war. Jack Rasmus is a longtime guest of the Global Research NewsHour. He's formerly a teacher and of economics at St. Mary's College in California, and the author and producer of the various nonfiction and fictional works, including the books The Scourge of a Neoliberalism, U.S. Economic Policy from Reagan to Bush in 2019, and
Trump,
Alexander
Reagan to
Mahal.
Trump, Reagan to Trump.
Oops, I'm sorry. Okay, Reagan to Trump, and Alexander Hamilton and Origins of the Fed. Also in March of 2019, and he also hosts the weekly radio program Alternative Visions on the Progressive Radio Network. Professor Rasmus joins us now. Nice to talk to you again, Dr. Rasmus.
My pleasure.
So, reviewing American imperialism, there are certain principles, 10 you listed, in fact, that all empires adhere to, but in fact, they all rise, they peak, and then they fall. And looking at history, why does any empire think that it will be different? What kind of thinking clouds the minds of people with access to basic scholarship?
Well, empires, those who manage and run the empire think the empires are going to last forever. And that's their mindset. And they think they should last forever. And they undertake activities to try to ensure they continue. It's not quite descriptive to say empires rise and then they fall. Empires go through crises periodically, and they may recover from the crises and reestablish a hegemony of some sort and go on and then have another crisis and recover. It's when they fail to recover from the inevitable periodic crises that they experience. And most of these crises that they fail at are because they can no longer afford to maintain the empire. And those empires are very expensive. You got a military, sometimes you got a colonial administration. You have to develop your economy to support it. It takes a lot of money to maintain an empire. As long as the empire and all empires attempt this, can continue to extract surplus from the countries it controls, then it will have sufficient resources, financial and economic resources, to afford the empire. But when the cost of empire outrun the ability to extract surplus resources, then the empire is in trouble. A good case example is the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire initially established wealth from plunder and then extraction of wealth from taxes and the surplus, mostly agricultural surplus from different parts of the empire. But when the Roman Empire lost those areas, the surplus generation, in other words, mostly agricultural surplus, wheats and grains and so forth, then it could not field a sufficient military in order to continue the empire. I mean, the Eastern Empire and the source of grain from Israel was cut off when the empire split. And then you had barbarian invasions, which took Spain and North Africa and Sicily, the Vandals, the Visigoths. So then the empire did not have sufficient resources in order to provide the military, and it reduced its border, its border forces, and that was it. It was over for the empire, and it died slowly. Okay. The same thing with the British. You know, the British Empire had this tremendous resource extraction from around the world, enabled by its navy. But then it entered World War One, and it was economically devastated in World War One. The U.S. Propped it up in the 1920s, but then World War Two came, and it went broke. All the European empires went broke. All they tried to maintain, you know, in Indochina and Algeria and places like that, but it was too late. Right? It was too late. They were broke. They had to turn over their empire, most of it, to the USA, in particular the Middle East. You know, was British. It turned it over to America. America extracted a very severe financial support for the Europeans during the war, and they had to pay the price, and they became secondary empire. They became an appendage of the American empire. Well, my argument is today, if you look around, the empire has become too costly. It cannot afford it the way it's structured now. And that's why last time we talked, you know, in my view, Trump is trying to restructure the empire, both at home in terms of the economy, to make it more affordable, to finance defense spending, which is well over $1 trillion now, $1.3 trillion, my estimate, per year, right? Pentagon's only $900 billion only, but it's going to $1 trillion. But then there's all other costs of empire that add another $300-400 billion to it. So $1.4 trillion every year. A lot of it is waste, particularly, you know, funding all these agencies, NGOs and USAID and so forth, and throwing all this money into Europe, which is not strategic to the U.S. anymore. And, you know, to recap what we said last time, Trump is trying to cut those costs, cut the costs within the Pentagon. You know, we have like 45 generals, four-star generals. You know, after World War II, we had four. Now we have 45. So this big bureaucracy has blossomed as the empire has continued. So he's trying to cut there. But the whole idea is not to cut it. It's to redistribute the savings into new strategic areas and new weapon systems. The U.S. is behind in certain weapon systems, drones, hypersonic missiles, et cetera. And of course, it wants to reorient to, you know, the main threat, which is China. And it's got itself bogged down in Ukraine. The neocons, the U.S. neocons and the Europeans manipulated Biden and got him sucked into their war, fighting their war for them. Just like the U.S. fights Israel's war in the Middle East, the Europeans got us to fight their war in Ukraine. The U.S. is paid mostly for that. So it was a big mistake, strategic error, by Biden, who was just manipulated. I mean, this guy was a lightweight when he was mentally acute, you know.
Yeah.
But he, you know, clearly it's coming out now that, you know, he's barely walking dead. So, you know, U.S. got sucked into that and wasted a lot of money, $300-400 billion so far. And Trump wants to shift that around. Now, we got the same situation in the Middle East with Israel, but it's different here. In that the Zionists control the U.S. Congress and most of the deep state bureaucracy in the U.S. They are so deeply entrenched that no one dares even criticize Israel.
They have more people in the Senate and in Congress than Trump has, probably.
Oh, absolutely. And a good number of them were former officers. Some of them were former officers in the Israeli Army Defense Force. You know, I mean, it's a big problem for the U.S. It's a big strategic problem for the U.S. And now we see ourselves embroiled in the Middle East again. I mean, we've supported Israel along for the same reasons. We've given Israel since 1978 in Camp David about $350-400 billion, you know, that's how much we've been throwing at Israel. Israel, you got to think about it, is the U.S. landlocked aircraft carrier in the Middle East. You know, that's what Israel is. And that political control, the Zionist control, which is not just the AIPAC and the foreign control, you know, from Israel. But you got all kinds of deep Zionists in the U.S. who are also supporters of Israel, and it's going to destroy the U.S. really eventually, yeah. I think. And we can see this going on in the Middle East. So the U.S. is stuck in another unaffordable war, which is about to explode, right? The U.S. very clearly has been involved with Israel in planning this attack on Iran. Mm-hmm. And I believe the U.S. will join that attack on Iran.
Iran will fight back.
Yes. And the question is, see, the U.S. and Israel can't do more than just an air war. You don't win wars just with air wars, right? I can't think of any yeah. conflict. But the U.S. cannot send military into Iran, will not. First of all, it doesn't have the forces to do that. It just has a professional army that's a global police force, right? And it always uses proxies. The U.S. is using Israel as a proxy. And Israel, of course, is using the U.S. in this case. But the same thing as Ukraine. You know, Ukraine was the proxy. The U.S. Has to have these major conflicts using proxies globally because it doesn't have the force or the public opinion support to send U.S. troops into any of these countries. You got to see Trump trying to pull out of Ukraine because the U.S. cannot afford wars in NATO in Europe, wars in the Middle East, and prepare for a war with China over Taiwan and the South China Sea Islands. You know, it just does not have the resources. And it doesn't have the resources when you look at what's happening with the deficit and the debt. You know, we are now chronically running $2 trillion a year deficits. That's mostly because, you know, we're spending $1.5 trillion or whatever a year on wars and defense. But at the same time, in the 21st century, well, actually, even a little earlier, we've been cutting taxes mostly on corporations and the wealthy and the rich. You know, we've cut $17 trillion in taxes since 2001, $17 trillion. Maybe $18 trillion now. And we spent $9 trillion on wars just in Iraq and Afghanistan. There's $26 trillion of the $35 trillion national debt, because deficits accumulated mean the national debt. So wars and tax cuts for the rich have been the primary cause of these huge deficits. But they can't continue spending on wars and tax cutting for the rich. You see, that's the dilemma they face.
And so in addition to that, you also have to consider that one of the things that Iran can do is shut down the Straits of Hormuz, which is like a 33 kilometers through which about 20% of the world's oil passes. So the price of gas is going to go up, and the price of oil and all the things associated with that. So that's on top of it. And then they're still cutting taxes of the rich. So I don't know if there's does there come a point when, is collapse, is it going to be inevitable, or is it going to come soon, or can it be continued? And is what the things that Trump doing going to bring on the collapse even sooner?
That's a good question. You know, Trump's, by the way, before I answer that, you talked about the Straits of Hormuz. Well, that's why the U.S. has sent 3 aircraft carrier task forces to the Arabian Sea, right? Yeah. If they try to shut it down, the U.S. is going to attack all those ports in Iran on the sea to open it up again. That's for sure. That's why they're sending them there. And they got another task force in the Mediterranean. They have four aircraft carrier task force, you know, with submarines, missile launching submarines and Arleigh class destroyers and so forth. The U.S. does not commit resources like that unless it has a plan to attack, right? You got to understand that. And you got to understand how this is very much like Iraq in 2003, right? Look at Iraq in 2003. What was the argument? Oh, weapons of mass destruction, yellow cake, right? Oh, you know,
yeah.
We got to get rid of it. What's the excuse now? Oh, Iran has a bomb, or they'll have a bomb in 2 weeks. Even though in March, the IAEA said there's no evidence, right? And the US DNI said there's no evidence that Iraq is immediately going to have a bomb. There's no evidence of that, right? And then you get in negotiations, and the same thing is happening that happened with Iraq. The US, while it's building up and preparing, it's in negotiations. You see, it always goes to lull the other side of negotiations. Well, negotiations have been going on with Iran, and in fact, they were supposed to occur here on the weekend until, you know, Israel scuttled the whole thing. But that's all part of the strategy too. You negotiate, but when you've decided to go to war and the wheels of war are cranking, the U.S., you know, you can't pull it back. The U.S. won't pull it back. I believe it's past the point of no return here, and it's going to engage in that. You don't send forward task forces, you know, without a plan to attack. This talk about, oh, it's the bomb, you know, oh, we got to get rid of the bomb, Israel says, right? Yeah, they'd like to do that. But really what this is about is regime change, you see?
Yeah.
This is the, and that was the case of 2003. You know, Saddam was engaging in negotiations. Saddam made the U.S. offer, send the IAEA, as American inspectors can come in. You can go anywhere you want. See that we don't have WMDs. Of course, I didn't prove that later that they didn't. Well, once the U.S. had decided, it didn't care about whatever offer the, you know, the other side made. It would just move the goalposts, make it even more difficult. You know, the U.S. at the end there wasn't demanding in Iraq, wasn't demanding, okay, we want to send inspectors everywhere to make sure there's no WMDs. It was dismantling your military to Saddam, right? And the same thing is going on now with Iran, right? It's not about the bomb. It's about regime change. Iran has said in the past week, we will sign a non-nuclear no proliferation. We will agree. You, America, can send your own inspectors in to see, you know, as well as IAE, that we're, you know, where we are in relationship to the bomb, and we will agree to any kind of treaty, any kind of writing that you want, that we won't develop a weapon. Well, this is not being reported that much in the U.S. media, right? But Iran is saying, you know, before the attack, was saying all of this. But the U.S. didn't care, you see.
Yeah.
The U.S. has made a decision to support Netanyahu, whose objective has always been to suck the U.S. into the war. And he knew he could do it because he's got all this political influence in the U.S. government and with Trump as well. So it's the same thing going on in 2003 in Iraq. It's the same march towards war. The machine is cranking, and the U.S. is going to engage, I believe, here with them. But it'll be an air war. And the question is, can Iran sustain, you know, its government and its economy given an air war? And the second question is, will Russia and China allow their ally, Iran, to collapse? Like Syria, you see Syria, they had to clear Syria out before they do this. This enabled, encouraged the loss of Syria and enabled, encouraged them to really start the war with Iran.
You know that the third adjustment in the 1980s, the neoliberalism, and then it blew up in around 2008, 2009, right? And now we're into this fourth readjustment.
Restructuring, attempt to restructure the empire, right?
Yeah. So what would you, if you were in a position to make a new set of adjustments and if the empire would act, or your colleagues would actually agree to what you're saying, what do you think might help save some of the empire, you know, at least for a little while longer? Because it doesn't seem like it's on a good trajectory right now. Well, what would you do as a substitute, do you think?
Well, you know, look at what Trump was trying to do initially. At least he talked about it. I think it's dead now. He wanted to pull the U.S. back to the Western Hemisphere and Asia, you know, Pacific Ocean and Asia and the Western Hemisphere, and extract the U.S. commitments in Europe and the Middle East. That was the talk, you know, Greenland and all that stuff, right? That was all about pulling back to the Western Hemisphere and relying on these two oceans. You know, I mean, the U.S. is not threatened by anything coming from Europe side or whatever. That was his attempt. I don't. You got to understand Trump. Trump has ideas. He talks big, right? But when he tries to implement them, he runs into the deep state, and the deep state checks him. Or if it's tariffs and whatever, the big corporations check him. No, you can't do that. And he pulls back. That's his, the way he operates. You know, he talks big. He has these ideas to get public appeal and support for him, but he always retreats. You know, that's why they call him Taco Trump, right? Trump always chickens out, TACO. Well, it's not a personality thing, it's the way the system works now. You see, the presidents don't have that much power. The presidents, it's the deep state that runs the country. You know, that's the bureaucracy, the Pentagon, all of that stuff. Trump has made some token moves to put people in to try to reform it. I don't think he's going to succeed in trying to reform the deep state. And you can see whenever it comes push to shove, they push him and he backs off, right? He thought, you know, I'm going to get this Ukraine negotiations and so forth. And the neocons and pretty much just said, no, you can't do that, right? So he's backed off. And the same thing in the Middle East. He falls into the deep state and the neocons lap every time. And that's what's happening now. That's what's happening in the Middle East. That's what's happening in Ukraine. They are the deep state, the neocons are reasserting their control over Trump, and they're going to wait him out. And you know, he caves in. He talks big, but he caves in. That raises the question, what do they really have on him? You know, you're sure, for sure, you know, the deep state has some shit on this guy, you know, and I think it makes him back off when push comes to shove here. He
I
may
don't.
want to do things, but he gives up. And that's what we see going on in
I
the
don't
Middle
know
East.
if your book touches on this subject, but what can ordinary Americans do? Can they do anything to make the decline of America under Trump or the deep state or what have you? You can't change them, but can you at least can they do things on the ground on the street to at least make the decline of their nation less vicious going into the years ahead?
Well, in the 21st century here, what we've seen is an attack on democracy from both parties, both wings of the corporate party of America, and with their friends in the Supreme Court, right? They are delimiting, you know, the space to act democratically. I mean, with a small d, you know, with I mean, it starts with Bo Gore versus Bush versus Gore, right? Supreme Court selects the president, right? And then what you get is Citizens United, and I believe they opened those floodgates and they corrupted the hell out of the Democrat Party, and it's, you know, it's not the party of workers or anything anymore. It's a party of big money, you know. And then we have the elimination of campaign finance reform, right? And then we have the pulling of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. We've got gerrymandering authorized by the Supreme Court, so that's only 30, 40 seats in the House change every election. They've tightened up the Democrat, you know, the democracy control by eliminating democracy, voter suppression. You know, I could go on. There's all kinds of civil liberties, you know, the Patriot Act, NDAA, all that stuff. You got a picture in the 21st century as the empire is going to war, forever wars. The empire is stuck in forever wars, right? It's not going to end. To enable it to continue that and to continue, shifting the surplus domestically from, you know, working class to the rich, They're destroying democracy. That's part of neoliberalism. You see, neoliberalism is antagonistic to democracy. It can't continue. And it's enabled, the eliminating of democracy is a limit is enabling neoliberalism to continue. I think he's not going to be able to restructure the economy again because the deep state is too embedded, right? The president has a limited power and authority. Congress is controlled by the big corporations, the military industrial complex, the pharma, health complex, the big tech companies, all these. They're not going to bring back the jobs. They don't want to. They're just waiting him out. He's not going to do that. If you look at the decline of empire in the 21st century when it's accelerating, really two main developments. One's the Iraq War and the start of forever wars, right? And the other is the 2008-9 crash. The US has not recovered from either of those so far. If you look at GDP after the crash of 2008-9, it grew maybe two-thirds of normal throughout Obama's period. It never really fully recovered. Then we get the COVID crash of 2021, and they threw $10 trillion of fiscal monetary stimulus at it at that time. And what did we get? We got a 2.5% GDP, a normal average two and a half GDP after $10 trillion between 22 and 24. That's the picture. I mean, if they didn't throw 10 trillion, we'd be in a depression right now. But the point is, $10 trillion to get you a normal 2.5% GDP growth rate is broken. It's broken.
It's certainly not sustainable. But
No.
anyway, I think we have to call it a close to this conversation now. But I've really enjoyed hearing from you. And your book is entitled Twilight of American Imperialism, and it comes out in October.
Yes.
And yeah, good. So thank you for your participation in this program. I really appreciate it, and look forward to reading the book in full when it comes out.
Yeah, we'll talk about the forever wars for
Okay,
sure,
for sure.
and the economic long-term economic crisis and the breakdown of neoliberalism. That's part of it. It's a secondary issue because neoliberalism propped up the empire, gave it another 3 or 4 decades of life, in the 1980s. But their contradictions are maturing, and it's not working. Neoliberal policies are not working. And the question is there something else that can save the empire, right? Will Trump be able to do it, both economically and politically? But I think right now my thesis is he's going to fail. He's going to fail.
Professor Jack Rasmus is an author and a broadcaster, and his website is jackrasmus.com. That concludes this week's show. Next week, we will have a feature conversation with our colleague and friend, James Corbett, about his brand new book, Reportage: Essays on the New World Order. Join us in 7 days. Listening to the Global Research News Hour, a program funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on the traditional lands of the Anishinaabe, the Innu, the Ojibwe, the Dene, and the Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. The show can air on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and is available for streaming or download on the site globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, please email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I've been your host, Michael Welch. Thanks once again for joining us.